Filipino journalist Maria Ressa has been working to expose government corruption and the misdeeds of the powerful, but that's, of course, put her on a collision course with the government in the Philippines of President Rodrigo Duterte. Maria Ressa spent nearly 20 years working as CNN's lead investigative reporter in Southeast Asia. And then she set up a social news, a digital news network, Rappler, in the Philippines. And now, in what critics of the regime describe as a politically motivated persecution, she's being accused of cyber libel and tax evasion. The prominent human rights lawyer Amal Clooney is among her admirers and is defending her at her presumably upcoming trial. I asked Maria Ressa how things are in Manila during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Still more focused on security rather than public health. Our levels of testing still need to increase, but I guess that's the same for every country around the world. It's just that our police were told, like early on, this is like April 1, the president said, shoot them dead if they violate quarantine. So it's crazy in that sense.
And have many people been shot dead for breaching quarantine?
There are two cases where they were both killed, like a day after. So the president said that on a nationwide address, April 1. April 2, a 63-year-old farmer was stopped at a checkpoint because he wasn't wearing a mask. And then a fight between him and the cop who was there. Cop in his report says the farmer was drunk and he kills him. Nothing. It's just like a blip. I write about it. I wrote about it in a Time article but it just went. And then just a week ago, a former colonel in the military who has PTSD was stopped at a checkpoint, and the cops, who are now dressing like the military, right? So they're wearing military fatigues. The cops thought he was reaching for a gun and they shot him and killed him. He was buried this Sunday. And then just this Sunday, again, there have been these instances where the police go into private areas, and there's a Spanish man who the police tried to arrest in his own home, which is unconstitutional. And that's kind of our story of the last 2 days, right? That's the back and forth. And today the police just defended it, saying that cop was doing his job. When, again, it's an abuse. It's an over-reliance on violence and arrests. I think we've had 30,000 people arrested since, at a time when the courts aren't working. So how do these people post bail?
Under Duterte, the police must have been so emboldened that they probably feel they can do anything, do they?
Absolutely. A drug war that says if they attack you, you can turn around and defend yourself. That's the standard line of President Duterte, and that's the standard line of all of the cases of it's impunity to kill. That's what he's given them a license to do in the drug war. And increasingly, how do you kill somebody for violating a checkpoint?
Let me talk about your relationship with the government. The latest figures I have on you is that you have been arrested and bailed 8 times in the last year. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
What are the charges that they have made against you?
So it ranges from securities fraud to tax evasion to cyber libel. All the cases except for the cyber libel case stem from one set of facts, one transaction. When Rappler issued Philippine depository receipts to Omidyar Network. So, we could also say that's forum shopping, but it's very difficult to even make a case like that. The tax evasion cases were given to, they were filed against Rappler 6 months or so after the government had actually given us an award for being a top corporate taxpayer in our revenue district. So it was like the old world flipped. In 2018, the Philippine government began 11 investigations and cases, and they tried to file cases against us, 11. And that was whittled down to 8 in 2019 when they issued arrest warrants. And then, you know, I've been a journalist. This is my 34th year as a journalist, and I would never have thought I'd be arrested for doing my job. I was arrested twice in a 5-week period, and I was detained once. Experiences I wish I didn't have, but, you know, it gave me a clear personal experience of the abuse of power.
The name Omidyar, which you mentioned earlier, relates to Pierre Omidyar, who was the founder of eBay, I think. And he was problematic, according to the government, because he invested money in Rappler, and then the government was able to say that the control had been sold to a foreign entity. Is that correct?
That's what the government says. That's not the facts, especially since this is not a one-off deal. This is a deal that was done with full transparency with the regulatory groups of government. Rappler is not the only news group that uses Philippine depository receipts. The top television networks, the top two, also have Philippine depository receipts. And in fact, the government tried to use that same argument against the top television network, ABS-CBN, this year in February. Instead of preparing for the virus, it was running after the top broadcaster refusing to give it a franchise and charging it with the same case as we have, which is that by issuing Philippine depository receipts, that they are allowing foreign control. This is a huge stretch of the imagination, especially since Rappler is a startup. You know, this was created by journalists. And in our shareholders agreement, the journalists actually have not just editorial control, but full economic control. So this is us. And part of the reason I think we've fought back as much as we have is we have no other business interests to protect. That's the way the Duterte administration has intimidated others, by attacking the business. For Rappler, we have no other businesses, and we will hold the line. We will stand up for our rights and call a spade a spade. These are politically motivated charges that are meant to stifle press freedom, that are meant to shut us up. And yet we continue. You know, I guess that's the best part. It's been 4 years. We continue to challenge impunity. First in the drug war, and this is as early as 2016, we began to challenge the impunity of groups like Facebook, which enabled government propaganda war against its own citizens.
Let's talk about the founding of Rappler, because that goes back to the very end of 2011, 2012, I think. Why did you start it up?
At that point, I realized that technology was a massive game changer. And the last book I wrote leading to that, it was called From Bin Laden to Facebook, looked at how the virulent ideology of terrorism, of Al-Qaeda, groups like Al-Qaeda, cascaded through social networks. And if you think about it, social media are social networks on steroids, right? So we started, while I was writing that book, I was playing around with the idea of how can we begin to use this new technology for journalism? Because that was, after I left CNN after almost 20 years, I ran the Manila Bureau and the Jakarta Bureau. I decided to come home and I took over ABS-CBN, the other network, the largest network that also came under attack by President Duterte. I ran that for 6 years. And then I decided that, you know, legacy news groups were missing something. And it had something to do with technology. And I took time off to write this book and really look at the macro parts of it and how the very things that made legacy news groups successful in the past, which were very efficient workflows, the kind of quality to get to that would require four people going out on one shoot versus today we have in a digital landscape one person doing all those four jobs. So we started looking at that. And when I finished writing the book, I thought we needed to redefine journalism. And we came up with this kind of structure that the core of journalism, of investigative journalism, which are the standards and ethics, holding power to account, that's critical. Then that's the second part of the Venn diagram is technology. If you marry technology to that, then you begin to think differently. And then the third part circle in that Venn diagram is community. So when we pulled Rappler together at the end of 2011, the elevator pitch was one phrase: Rappler builds communities of action. By that point, I was tired of just throwing stories into a black hole. We wanted to create an organization that would be able to use technology to go to people where they are. And, you know, the Philippines has a median age of 23 years old, and they were on social media. And that's what we did. That's why we created Rappler. And part of the reason I think we also became targeted by the administration is of the major news groups in the Philippines, Rappler has the demographic that will determine the future. Our largest audience is 18 to 35 years old. So that led to it, that exploration as a journalist of the way ideas spread through social networks led to the creation of Rappler based on these lines, using technology, but infused with the standards and ethics of journalism to create impact in our world.
Is it problematic at all to tie journalism to that kind of civic engagement and social action?
You know, it was a process for us. It's a process for me. You know, coming from CNN in the past, where they're very different, right? When I came home to the Philippines in 2005, I realized that in the Philippines, journalists, and this is ABS-CBN, is the only news group that at that point had a helicopter. So the Philippines is the third most disaster-prone country in the world. We have an average of 20 typhoons every year. Always first on the scene is that helicopter with our journalists. But just like when I was in East Timor for CNN, you face the same dilemma if you are the reporter there. When people don't have water or food, you can't do your reporting. And I felt guilty drinking my water if I can't share my water. So one of the first things we did with ABS when I came in was to say, hey, look, we have 6 seats in our helicopter. We put 3 seats for the journalists, and then our foundation will bring relief goods for the other 3 seats. So that was the next journey that I went through. And you know, what's interesting to me is that CNN itself went through that when Hurricane Katrina hit. They were providing food when you almost have to do it. When we started Rappler, we created a line between the investigative journalists and our civic engagement arm. In fact, we called it a different name. It was called Move PH. And it's run by a different group. And, you know, it was difficult to kind of inculcate this to our government, because the Move PH, the civic engagement arm, would work very closely with government. It had 38 government partners. And yet the investigative journalists would be knocking on the door of those same officials who were working with our civic engagement arm and demanding really tough answers. That was in 2012. When Super Typhoon Haiyan hit in 2013, we had already begun building, actually with the Australian government's help, we began building a platform called Project Agos. And this was a disaster risk reduction platform that would put all of the social media calls for help. We systematized a hashtag along with other news groups and the government. And then we put it on a platform where the government could respond effectively, efficiently, and then we would all be able to see it in a transparent manner on the website. It's in real time. So we had been working on that. And when Super Typhoon Haiyan hit, it was very confusing to the Secretary of Social Welfare and Development, because they were under stress as well. But I think over time, this is now, we're entering our 9th year. And we've survived 4 years of sustained government attacks. I'm actually pretty happy, I guess. You know, we've set out we've done what we've set out to do.
What particularly seemed to enrage President Duterte was your mapping, Rappler's mapping of his hidden networks of influence, yes?
I think it was one of the things. I think the first was really the drug war. That is a critical pillar of the way President Duterte leads, because he leads with violence and fear. And to have a news group constantly challenge the numbers, they keep changing in plain sight, was it not just an irritant. They wanted us to stop, and they did all they could to do that. Then in addition to that, when we began to realize that there was active manipulation going on, that this is being supported, not just implicitly, but also funded, and the lead content creators are then later on were appointed to government offices, you know, that is unconstitutional, this kind of manipulation of public opinion. So power doesn't like it when you challenge it. And I think in this day and age, and you don't just see this in the Philippines, you see this all around the world, you see this in the United States, the old norms of allowing that kind of checks and balances are gone. Now it's a very adversarial relationship. There's nothing that is professional about it. And I think it was challenging at the beginning for us in Rappler to figure out what was going on. I mean, imagine when we came out with the Propaganda War series in 2016. This is a few months after President Duterte was elected. I received an average of 90 hate messages per hour. That was the first time that we've seen anything like this. And it was also the first time I could see how social media, the distribution of social media, could be used to pound a narrative to silence, to pound people to silence, and then at the same time to create a bandwagon effect to make people believe a lie is true, and vice versa. It was a scary dystopian landscape. And I think part of the reason the government didn't like the challenge we posed is that we exposed what they were doing.
Putting aside the morality of it for a moment, why were you so surprised? I mean, you were using Facebook, right? Facebook offered you a platform in the early days.
Yes.
Why did it surprise you that Facebook was so powerful?
I think it's not that it was so powerful. That wasn't a surprise. It was that as it grew and became even more powerful, that in that process, news groups and journalists had given up their gatekeeping, our gatekeeping powers, and that the technologists, Facebook, Twitter, you know, in the Philippines, it's really Facebook, YouTube, that these are now the new gatekeepers. And yet they are not imbued with any sense of responsibility, either ethically or morally, to protect the public sphere where democracy happens. That's the shocker for me.
To protect the public sphere from what? What was it that was happening that should not have been allowed to happen?
It's information warfare. And you can jump off to the way Russian disinformation works, right? I mean, it began in 20... Part of the way we were able to deal with this is I looked at what happened in the Ukraine in 2014 and some of the data work that the groups there had done and how they had pushed back against Russian disinformation. So this was part of the military doctrine of China, that they actively manipulated public opinion. And I think what none of us in the West... and I will include the Philippines in that. What we didn't imagine was that this could be utilized as, propaganda on steroids, and I'll tell you how, like, naive I was about this. I really drank the Kool-Aid. I thought this is social media for social good. And what shocked me, in May of 2016, during the election, someone asked me whether a dictator could take office again in the Philippines. And I was like, no, that can't happen. We have social media. And then a few months later, just after President Duterte took office in July of 2016 with the beginning of the drug war, that's when the weaponization of social media began. This is unique. It hadn't been done before. And I think if you look at it, we were kind of a testing ground. Cambridge Analytica, when that was exposed, when Chris Wiley came forward as a whistleblower, it was no surprise that he called the Philippines a petri dish for Cambridge Analytica and its parent group. It's called SCL. And, you know, the United States had the most number of compromised accounts on Facebook in that scandal, in the Cambridge Analytica scandal. The country with the second most compromised accounts was the Philippines. We were a testing ground because, I guess maybe because the Philippines was a former colony, a former protectorate of the United States, an English-speaking country. It's 100 million people. You test it here, it works. You then transport it.
So you asked Facebook. You've got a quite a strong relationship with Facebook and some of the executives. In fact, I think that you went to see Mark Zuckerberg. You asked Facebook to take down, I don't know, a couple of dozen suspected fake accounts. Fake and run presumably by Duterte's supporters behind some kind of screen or other, were they?
So what Grappler did was to continuously expose the networks of disinformation. We created a database of the information ecosystem in our country and showed you how these networks of disinformation evolved and how they worked, right? And once Facebook, and this was in 2018 when Mark Zuckerberg was called to Congress, Facebook asked Grappler to become one of its two fact-checking partners in the Philippines. We said yes, because anything, you know, I was looking for constructive ways to deal with it. And the reality is that the only people who could actually change the reality of our information ecosystem are the social media platforms themselves. So we began to work with Facebook. They did three takedowns from October 2018, January 2019, and then March 2019. Only three. One of those takedowns, Grappler had already published a three-part series 13 months before it was taken down. Another one of the networks was a network that we had been monitoring. The third network, I think what all of these networks had in common was one man. He handled the social media platform for the Duterte campaign. And he is probably, I believe until today, he's the only private person that has been named by Facebook in these takedowns. You know, Facebook, very early on, one of the first takedowns they did after they came under pressure was Myanmar, and they banned the generals from the platform, right? They named them. But this man, his name is Nick Abunada. He was Gabunada. He's the only private person that's been named by Facebook. So these networks were somehow or other working, and Facebook's term is CIB, coordinated inauthentic behavior. But then you run into trouble. What happens? It's like, so let me put it this way. It's like introducing a virus into a system. What happens when more people are infected, right? And then they're real people. And then these real people with real identities, some of them paid, some of them not. What happens when they are the ones amplifying it? I think that's the bigger challenge for Facebook. And I'm not so sure that they ever effectively found a solution to that. The most interesting thing is in a pandemic, they are taking down tweets, posts, the content that they never have done with political speech.
What are they taking down?
We saw Rudy Giuliani. This is Twitter took down Bolsonaro and Giuliani's tweets. Bolsonaro, because he basically says that you don't need social distancing. You don't need to be physically distant from someone. Things that are life-threatening. And I guess the appeal that I continue to make is that truth is critical in any democracy. The facts are critical in any democracy. And that that could be life-threatening. It certainly, you know, as a period, for a period of time, was threatening to me. These cases that have been filed by government were pushed viral on Facebook, even if they're lies. And there are Filipinos who believe they're real. It's like fertilizer. When the government wants to do something that is that they perceive they could get pushback on, they first seed, they fertilize the ground on social media before they take action. And, you know, the best example of this is Senator Laila de Lima, who was arrested in February of 2017, has been in prison since then, continues to be in prison until today, for being critical of President Duterte. The charges against her are laughable charges of being a drug warlord, but essentially she was the one who, when she was head of the Commission on Human Rights, went after him for human rights violations when he was mayor. And she, as a member of the Senate, was already beginning to look at the extrajudicial killings in the drug war. She was the first cautionary tale for politicians. And I became the cautionary tale for journalists. And, you know, by focusing on us, then it creates a climate of fear for anyone else who should be challenging a lot of the things that we're seeing happen. All of this, of course, has changed now with the coronavirus, with the pandemic. And I think that, you know, while it's tragic, I think we have no idea what the real numbers are because the tests are so limited. And we will live through so much more pain before this is over. There are some silver linings. You know, silver lining number one is that the Duterte administration has to deliver. It has to work. And the very things that it used to gain and hold power are the very things it must now work against. What are they? The first is they can't lie. Facts matter. So these kinds of disinformation campaigns that it was using against its people lost their, not just intensity, real people came up and challenged it. And for a little while, this is, I believe April 1 or 2, when the president threatened to, he told the police and the military that if anyone violated quarantine, he told them, and this is a direct quote, he said, shoot them dead. And that infuriated real Filipinos. And overnight, it trended number one in the Philippines and trended globally into April 2. So when that happened, Filipinos are finding their voices. Facts matter. And then I think the second one is that in order to fight the pandemic, you need a whole of nation approach. One of the tactics the Duterte administration has used is to divide and conquer, to demonize us against them. These tactics are very similar to what terrorists use, right? Us to polarize, which is also built into the design of social media. Now they have to work to unite the society. And I think, you know, I'm hoping they learn faster because, frankly, where they go, we go.
I'm talking to head of the digital news network, Rappler, Maria Ressa, who is one of President Duterte's public enemies, number one, I suppose. Is it a personal antipathy that President Duterte has against you, do you think?
It's a tough question because I don't really know. I don't have a personal relationship with him, but I have interviewed him as early as 1987, 88. You know, I was a reporter working for CNN at that point. And when I first interviewed him again in 2015, he did remember our last interview. If I remember that story correctly, I pointed out the alleged human rights violations. But we were very cordial. And then even after he became president in December of 2016, I did another interview with him. And again, he's very cordial when he wants to be, right? Since
you
then,
mean charming.
He's called charming. Yes.
Yeah.
Charming in his own way, right? Anyone can be charming when they want to be. But I understood why President Duterte got elected. And he did use social media effectively. I think he's the first politician, certainly the first candidate for president to do so.
He got elected presumably because of the Law and Order platform, people thought that he was going to, you know, stamp out corruption and bring order to the Philippines. He made no secret of his propensity for violence, did he?
Not at all. In fact, he embraced it. And what was interesting is, just like Trump was elected, it was kind of like the perfect storm. Filipinos were tired of what it perceived as elite politics, of liberal democracy that had a trickle-down effect that didn't trickle down. And this is what also what's interesting is, I think the Duterte administration is extremely good at information dissemination. What they did during that time period was, from the time the campaigns began until the time it ended, I was looking at one factor, which was, you know, before his campaign began, the number one concern of Filipinos had always been jobs. By the time his campaign was nearing its end, the number one concern of Filipinos was drugs, right? And drugs went from number eight to number one during the time that the campaigns were going on. So he said this to me himself. He said, I understand the Filipino. And he does. So I think working with some very good social media advice, and this is where you go back again to Cambridge Analytica, because Alexander Nix, the president of Cambridge Analytica, came to the Philippines in November 2015, right before the campaigns began. And there's a photograph of him with some of the members of the campaign team of President Duterte, soon to be President Duterte. So again, he got very good advice, and he did something that we've never lived through in the Philippines. I think, unfortunately, that also came with a move, not just to authoritarianism, but, you know, increasingly a more dictatorial form of governance. And President Duterte has never made any bones about this. He said his hero was Ferdinand Marcos.
Well, I was going to say, you've had experience with this kind of government before with Marcos, have you not?
Just 33 years ago, 33 yeah. years after the fall of Marcos in 1986, President Duterte was putting in place the same types of machinery, empowering the military. The police now during lockdown are wearing military fatigues. You know, again, that's interesting to me. And we were just talking about that. When did they lose their police uniform? Because that's what distinguishes, you know, the police they have powers to arrest. The military doesn't. I mean, these are all the different, all of these things that were embedded in our constitution are being challenged. And I've always called this, what we're seeing is democracy's death by a thousand cuts.
Maria, since 1987, nearly 180 journalists have been killed in the Philippines. Are you not worried?
I think worried is, I don't think about it like that. The way I think about this is that I've spent my entire career as a journalist. I've had some amazing experiences and stories that have changed societies I've lived in. I was there at the fall of Suharto. I had the first interview with BJ Habibie when he became president. I've watched every Southeast Asian country go from, not every, you know, because you still have the Sultan of Brunei, but the Southeast Asian countries go from authoritarian one-man rule to democracy. And that started with the Philippines in 1986. So I had these, I guess I've been a journalist for so long that it's made me who I am. My values are determined by the profession that I've lived. And you know what journalism is like. It demands so much of you. And I guess for me, it came down to, when we came under attack, do you buckle? Do you give up who you are? Or do you protect not just who you are, but the Constitution that is under attack, the democracy that I watched spring up, right? I mean, and I guess I felt like I didn't have a choice, because the baton was passed to my generation of journalists, and I happened to be here. And, you know, just because I'm being threatened doesn't mean that one is up to you, how I reacted to it. And you know what? When I pushed back and Rappler pushed back, we did some of the best investigative journalism, some of the best work that we've ever done. And I think it also inspired us. And that goes to where is journalism going to go to next, right? We were able to create, actively create journalism for today, evolve it for the future. And in a time of pandemic, even more, right? We face even more challenges. But now facts matter even more because this is life and death. If you don't have the right information, you could literally die. So I think, you know, as the challenges go, I began to look at it as, okay, I'll just, of course I get afraid, right? I just embraced my fear, spent time to conquer that, and then I move forward. And I think that's the way I attack it.
Do you have security?
I did. Now in pandemic, you don't really need much, right? I mean, no. Think about it like this. I'm locked down, right? So if you think about it, Rappler, under attack for the last 4 years. Now our entire society is under attack by a virus. So for us, it's an easing of the attacks. We're no longer the only ones under attack. Well, if you look at it early this year, the administration went after ABS-CBN. So again, we weren't the only one. We were just the cautionary tale to keep everyone in line. And we didn't follow what the government wanted, which is to shut down. And the best part is we were forced to become more creative in business. And because in 2018, when the government filed all these cases and it arrested me, all of a sudden, our advertising dropped 50%. So by April, it had dropped 50%. And so we pulled our team together and said, what is it that we do as journalists that we can turn into a product that our sales team can sell that isn't advertising? Because Lord knows, one of the things I've learned in covering people power and transitions of government, business is never one of the first people pushing for change. They'll be among the last, right? So as the advertisers pulled out, what we did is we looked for what they would need. And using the same set of skills that we used to find the disinformation networks, to look at the data of social media, to begin to understand the information ecosystem, we were able to put tools together that allowed us to grow a model beyond advertising. So we're in a good place. I guess that's, you know, it goes to Nietzsche's quote, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
So what is the model? Where does your money come from?
I mean, it's money. Like, so it's ads. Our advertising is down to maybe 25% of our... In 2019, we actually made a little bit of money. I'm still waiting for our audited results, but this B2B model. Right now, we're advertising is the only thing that many news groups tend to do. Then we began, many news groups began a reader revenue model. We do have a membership model on Rappler, which... Our team always jokes because our membership spikes every time I get arrested. So they keep saying, you should stay longer in jail. I'm like, guys, you don't love me. You know? But this, what we found was that the very same things we used to understand what was happening in the digital landscape are also tools that other corporations need. When you say you build communities of action, other companies are trying to do that now. And so we created a business that's based on technology and data that we created for Rappler. And we've turned it into a product. And that part of our sales team has grew the end of 2017 when it was non-existent to 2019, it grew 1,200%. So we're okay. Right? Shockingly so. That's why all of a sudden Nietzsche is my favorite quote.
Nevertheless, on one charge alone, which is under the Cybercrime Prevention Act, you face up to 12 years prison. Are you worried that any of these charges will stick?
So I prepared to lose every single case. And that is the reason why Amal Clooney is my lawyer. I have a team of international lawyers, Covington in the States, one of my classmates from college offered their services pro bono, and I was thrilled. They're working with members of Dowdy Street with Amal and Chanyagin Su. And their goal is to look for justice for me, to prepare for what could happen, right? Because I guess I'm, in this sense, I'm quite pragmatic. I know the risk. Amal's first thing, you know, when I was talking to her, and this was only in April of 2019, that's when it was dawning on me that, good God, I could go to jail. And it took Amal taking my case for me to realize the number of years, like all of the 8 cases, if I lose, the maximum penalty is over 100 years. The most I can serve, though, is 40 years, right? So 40 years in jail, that's still 40 years in jail. So at that point, I talked to Amal. I said, I think this is a press freedom. This is a constitutional, this is human rights violation. And we talked about it. Her thing, what she said is, you know, why are you going back? You're an American citizen. And I'm both. I'm an American and I'm a Filipino citizen. But I chose to be Filipino, you know. But she said, why don't you just leave? And I was like, no, I can't. Will you defend me? Will you find a way if I lose the cases? And it took her a few months because when she was studying all the cases, in the end, the government has all, the cards are stacked against me. But I haven't given up hope, right? Because in the end, the justices, the judges who are holding each of these cases, I hope that they are guided by the spirit of the Constitution, the spirit of the law, and that at the worst, I guess, if they decide that the case is against me, their names will be chronicled. I don't want to be intimidated without the people responsible being held to account. And this is one way to do that.
When are you up in, when do you face any charges? When are you up in court?
So the verdict for the cyber libel case, my lawyer said it was like the fastest case that they've seen ever in about 8 months. It was set for a verdict that it was supposed to have. It's called, what did they call it? The day that whatever the date is, it was set for April 3rd, the promulgation date. So that was the verdict of the judge. Mm-hmm. April 3rd, we were on lockdown. And so I received another notes from the clerk of court saying that they'll postpone it until April 24th. So this was, you know, we were all preparing for it. And we were, this is a case, cyber libel was actually thrown out by the government's own lawyers. And then they brought it up to the Department of Justice and the DOJ overturned it and filed the case against us anyway. So this is a ridiculous case. And after when the government declared a lockdown going until it's now until May 15th. Then we received notice from the court saying that the verdict date, the promulgation day, is now postponed indefinitely. So I don't know what will happen, but I do know that that I think a lot is at stake, and that's the reason.
Sorry to interrupt you. Do you think that the popularity and success of Rappler and the international support you've got, the fact that you're a dual citizen, the fact that you've got support from the EU and from, you know, people like Amal Clooney, does it mean you're too big to jail, to coin a phrase?
I don't know. It's uncharted ground. I've never seen my country like this. So I don't know. I've seen such impunity. I mean, if you look at the number of people killed in the drug war, human rights groups, the Commission on Human Rights, as of December last year, they estimated it was at least 27,000 people killed. The Philippine police admit to killing 6,000 people, right? That's been, the only 3 policemen have been held to account. That's a lot of deaths. So anything is possible. The fact that these cases have been filed show me anything is possible. So we fight it every day.
Maria Ressa, who runs the digital news network Rappler, she's based in the Philippines. In the course of that interview, we got a series of texts, all from the same number, and they go, I'll read them because it maybe gives an insight into what Maria Ressa is up against. The lady Philippine journalist is one of the bad Filipinos that only creates divisiveness. I wonder how much money she's receiving from other countries. She's a troublemaker. Then she sounds American. Then what basis does she accuse President Duterte of abuse of power? She's wanting to be popular with an American ideology. She's been away from the Philippines. Then I'm regularly going back and forth to the Philippines. I have good feedback from people. She's American inspired. Filipinos in New Zealand are not happy that she is disturbing the good works of President Duterte. Then she forgot that the basic principle of law is the benefit of the majority outweighs her private benefit. Then she should not insist that American style be used in the Philippines. She's ignorant about what difference should be ideal for the Philippines. Then she's an American, not a Filipino. Then she's a troublemaker. Then Rappler is only creating bad publicity instead of creating unity in the Philippines. Then why can't she face the reality that Duterte is supported by the majority of Filipinos? Then the trouble with her is she's insisting that Duterte use the American style of governing. And then what is her number? I think we'll keep that to ourselves, don't you?